Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit like, subscribe, and don't forget to hit that notification bell so you are alerted whenever we go live, as we are constantly adding new shows and doing new episodes, dropping clips. Yes, back to cutting clips from shows. Those are up. Last night, we had another episode of Pascal Robert's Mau Mau Hour. Last week, we did movie night last Friday, where we talked about Pump Up the Volume. We watched Pump Up the Volume, and we had a very fun discussion of it afterwards. If you want to be in the live audience for movie night, if you want to be part of the live audience for the Pascal Robert Mau Mau Hour, there's only one way. Become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. We're already in talks for another movie night. Actually, friend of show and my former neighbor, Ben Burgess, is in town. He's actually walked out for a bit as he's writing something for everyone's favorite magazine to complain about, Jacobin. But we're working on a whole new channel, doing something totally different. We'll be reviewing movies that Ben did not see, as he did not grow up with a television. And whenever I bring up a movie, it's like, nope, never saw it. So while he was living here, we would go back and watch a lot of these films, and we're going to do kind of a movie review show, a little more scripted, where we do that. So we're getting ready to do that. That's going to be fun. We're still going to the Champagne Room tonight, where we will be doing one of my more favorite segments, Body Jacking with Pascal Robert. Oh, I can see him in the virtual green room. He looks a little nervous, but you know it's a good time when I get to play DJ. Pascal gets to jack his body. Speaking of the body jacker, the Jack Master, as some of you guys call him, the man of the Mau Mau Hour, please welcome my co-host, my homie, my dog, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Peace and greetings to all.
Are you ready to jack your body?
Jack your body.
Are you ready to go down memory jack lane?
If you got some good music, you might be allowed to.
Yeah. It's always a good time for Body Jack Thursday. Speaking of jacking one's body, she is the faceless voice of reason on this show. Please welcome Kim Toussaint.
Check it. I'm always afraid of what kind of image M. Toussaint is doing behind the scene. What's the same? Jacking in a whole different kind of way with a different connotation. She's like,
Someone says Pascal is in a lighthearted mood. Pascal is generally in a lighthearted mood, and I really wish you guys were privy to the sermon that was going on beforehand.
Lighthearted sermon.
Kushlik's things he says about the intro music to me are like the greatest compliments and some of the funniest things ever. Can you put that on the screen, Toussaint? What do you just say?
Sure. Would you like to read it? I disassociated, and do you realize to avoid the brain blasting aneurysm of the intro music? Brain blasting
aneurysm.
You are one of a kind.
Really? Still to this day, every time the music comes on and Kushlik wrote that comment, the dance, remember we reviewed the dance kids?
Mm-hmm.
He said that was him when the TIR intro music comes on. That's still one of my favorite videos. If you guys haven't seen it and you want to see a more serious video here on TIR, please watch the clip of Toussaint and I breaking down the junior high dance competition at some school in somewhere in America. We never found out where that place was, right?
Somewhere in America. No, we never found out.
It could have been in France for all we know. Kushlik is partial to Bulgarian folk. Well, Kushlik actually likes it when we play house music. Did you know that?
He does?
Yeah. Kushlik is a house music fan. So because it's Body Jack Thursday and Pascal is going to jack his butt, he cannot help it. He's had a very stressful week. And it's time to unwind with a little, look at him. He's trying to hold it in.
Holding the jacking.
He can't hold in the jacking. Shout out to Bertram Cooper, who was on MSNBC today.
How's today?
Yeah, well, they were pushing it back. Originally, he was supposed to be on the day he came on the show.
Yes.
So, you know, we're not going to get into a long conversation about the affirmative action decision since we literally did a show. Was that 2 weeks ago, Toussaint?
It wasn't 2 weeks.
Just last week?
Last week. That was early this week.
Time moves so crazy.
It does.
But yeah, we did it affirmative before the ruling even came down.
That's right.
So very good show.
Came out today and they had him on today.
They had him on today. Yeah, the ruling came down today and they had him on today and he did a great job. You know, doing TV is very different than doing a podcast. You don't have
any time.
It's very quick. There is no, even doing like the Majority Report is uncomfortable for me because you're just on. There's
we
no.
We all know Jason likes to spread out. Take your time. The better part of an hour. Jack his body a little bit.
Check it. A little bit. But yeah. Yeah. When you get on some of these shows, what is the worst show you go on, Pascal, where you get no prep time whatsoever? They just like go.
Oh man. That has to be cable news, man. That has to be any cable news network.
Yeah. Cable news is the worst. I've never done cable news. I did TYT, and that's my favorite comment section of all time.
Yeah, boy. Yeah, boy.
The TYT comment section is a magical thing.
Truly.
Trying not to laugh as I can see these comments out of the corner of my eye, which I never get to see at the beginning of the show because usually I have the script up. And they're pretty funny. Toussaint, we need to do a contest.
Contest.
You made a community post about a contest. What's the contest going to be?
We're going to do contest or giveaway. Is that separate to you? Is that
different? The same thing. We're going to give something away. To the best what?
The best. The best comment about Jason's fashion sense. Because that used to be me.
That what? Well,
I came up with the taco meat. Of course you provided the taco meat.
I provided all the taco meat today.
Yes you did.
This is what I get for watching all these 70s movies.
Yep, this is what we all get.
Wow,
we are all the beneficiaries of Jason watching 70s movies.
And you see how quiet Pascal is? Doesn't defend me.
Oh, hell, this is my job now? You can't defend yourself?
No. You're supposed to shield me from these insults that are being hurled.
Listen, man, taco meat is a universal problem with men over 40. It has nothing to do with you. Just calm down.
Men over 40.
That's the new commercial where the sad guy is like afraid to unbutton his shirt. Don't tell Big Pharma that. They're just going to have a new taco meat hair removal system. Are you a black man over 40? Afraid to unbutton your shirt? But speaking of movies in the 70s, I rewatched a movie from 79. I rewatched the original Mad Max. Toussaint, being that you've never seen any movies, had you at least seen one of the Mad Max movies? Did you at least see Beyond Thunderdome with Tina Turner?
I did.
Okay, so you know who the character is.
I've probably seen all of them.
I don't believe that.
I've probably seen all of them.
Pascal, you've seen the Mad Max movies.
Yes.
What is your take on the Mad Max movies?
It's very grim, very apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has very interesting hair.
in the second one, so the first movie that comes out in 79 was done on such a small budget, they didn't have the ability to kind of world build the apocalyptic wasteland that you get in the sequel, which is Road Warrior, which is, it's kind of back to a primitive world. The first movie is done during a gas crisis in Australia, where people were literally fighting over the long queues or lines that were happening, and like fighting over filling up their tank over someone else. Like, hey, you know, you're only supposed to get so many, you know, liters of gas. You're taking more than the standard minimum, and there would be like literal fights over it. And that was kind of one of the big impetus for the director to write and make this revenge film, which was also very popular in this era as well, because you do have a rise in crime. So you get the Death Wish movies. Of course, you get movies like Dirty Harry. And as I've said on this show, I've been watching these movies more and more. And also, of course, because of the nature of the show, doing a lot of reading and watching of news, both locally and nationally, more smaller local stations. I think that's more interesting than national news coverage. And I feel like we're falling back into something that I like to call Mad Max syndrome. And I wrote a little something about it. it's a little long. Should we read that or just go into a conversation, guys?
I'm interested in the motivation, because Toussaint and I were talking about how we're noticing a theme with the direction of the creations you've been putting forth on the show.
Mm-hmm. In terms
of your analysis of phenomenon,
mm-hmm,
and how they are rooted in a certain kind of grim depiction of the current moment in reality. And we're wondering, is that, I don't think we're debating the actual reality of those analyses, because there are a lot of grim realities out there as well. But is it a possibility that it's a process of you looking at America from outside, living in Mexico, and kind of wanting to be here and not wanting to be here at the same time? In other words, kind of having a kind of melancholy relationship with the U.S. from afar?
The only thing that I want to do when I go to the United States is, like, if I have a speaking engagement or see my children. Other than that, there's really nothing for me in the United States. I don't do my shopping there. I've adapted to the fact that there's certain things I can't get that I was used to. And I do appreciate a certain quality of life even though there's certain things that I will lack. Like, you know, I don't have clean water here. I have to buy clean water. And there's other aspects of living here that are different. But, you know, you have to keep in mind, the moment I cross an imaginary line, there's a perception that where I live is a violent hellscape. And across this imaginary line is the ability to achieve certain goals, which is always, which I thought I understood, but I don't really understand anymore, because opportunity here, if you have a couple bucks, you know, you can start a business and be profitable pretty quickly. You don't have those opportunities, which is why so many Americans that, you know, aren't really well-to-do, at best we might call them working class or middle class or even lower middle class, can come here and start businesses and be, and when I say successful, you know, they're not balling or opening up multiple franchises, but they can pay bills and pay rent off maybe opening a small coffee shop, opening a burger joint, which they couldn't even have a taco cart with the costs across the line. And then when you look at, you know, the high cost of living and the fact that you have more intergenerational living here, which is like very, very acceptable. And the immediate homelessness that I see, like as soon as I cross the line and I take an exit to San Ysidro, there's people living in the McDonald's parking lot. There's cars. They just cleared a bunch out as they were doing some work on the road, but there was cars that stretched, you know, blocks. And that's just one city. Chula Vista has the same problem. National City has the same problem. And, of course, the city of San Diego has the same problem. I start to see encampments on the bridge on the freeway, you know, the bridges that go that you can walk over the freeway. And that's like the first thing I'm just like hit with. And then, you know, keep in mind, I did leave a situation. The Wall Street Journal did an expose. I sent it to you guys on homelessness in California, where they spent showed that California spent $17 billion in the last 4 years to fight homelessness. And a state that has 12% of the population of the country has 50% of the unhoused population, and it's just growing. It's not getting any better. And the images that the Wall Street Journal used was of where I lived. I literally saw, like, oh, Ben was here. I was like, oh, Ben, look, that's, I live right there. And so it does hit me a little harder, these grim realities. And as someone that grew up in a time where I'm being politically aware, because politics are literally affecting me and everyone like me, because either I'm public enemy number one or I'm going to die once I hit 18, right? These were the statistics that were hitting me once I turned 17, 18 years old. And where I don't see an immediate return to that time, because the drug dealers controlling the blocks at that time were street level. Now the drug dealers controlling the blocks are literally big pharma. And I think that's one of the things that I kind of wanted to touch on with what I was writing on, was that trying to get a handle on this is just so different, because no one wants to handle it from the top. Right. I mean, there was a big civil suit with the Sackler family, and you know, are they really going to pay that money? And if so, is it really going to affect them? Are we going to stop making pain medication? Should we stop making pain medication? I think this stuff has also changed the way we look at, you know, people that actually do suffer from chronic pain. It is harder for them to get certain medications. And so, because you can't point your finger and have that Crockett and Tubbs answer of, we're going to take down the big cartel, because the cartel is all legal, then it's street level dealers that are literally just dealing to support their own habit. It's users who in places like San Francisco, that was just a misdemeanor. And you never got charged for public use. And in San Francisco, just recently in the last month, the mayor London Breed's solution to this problem that, you know, a lot of people were calling for tougher sentences. And now that Chase Boudin is gone too, out of the DA's office, they brought the California Highway Patrol in to arrest more people for public use of narcotics. And that's a solution for a lot of people. And another solution for people is, well, you know, let's just give them what they want and put big walls up so no one can see it. And then that'll be okay. But the solutions are very similar to the solutions that we would see in these movies, where you have lawless hordes of people running amok. And in the first Mad Max, again, it's a little different because it's not placed in such a science fiction-y, cyberpunk-looking distant future. There is no time of when it doesn't say, like, this is this many years and there was this great war. It's just kind of like, this is in the not-so-distant future. And one of the themes in the movie is that Mel Gibson's character doesn't feel like he's a hero because he understands that the people that he's protecting kind of become collateral damage to catch the bad guys. And there's an exchange he has with his captain where he's like, the only thing separating me from the bad guy is his badge. And his captain's like, well, people need heroes. And I have a problem with that as well, because I do feel like people need heroes. And I don't say that because I think they need them. I feel like that's the way people feel. You know, last year I did a whole video essay on the fact that people feel the need for heroes. The way many people present electoral politics and take it in is good guys and bad guys. And this person is the right person for the job because they're going to save me from myself. And there's such a massive disconnect to any sort of like conversation about the consequences, and every hashtag is the end all be all solution for everything. So 3 years ago, when every city is on fire because people are mad about being inside, this really, really racist dude in the White House, people dying from a pandemic, nobody can get out of their house, people are afraid of what's going to happen afterwards. We just don't know. It was such a frightening time of I don't know, right? And then you keep seeing these police murders or vigilante killings. And there's only so much you can take. It wasn't like before this happened, we weren't seeing this ad nauseum. And it just became the running story. So after George Floyd and all the protests, then every news story was about a cop overreaching. So every solution was, if we stop police overreach, then we can kind of solve the problems of poverty. We never have like serious class analyses. You know, in rereading Cedric Johnson's book, Beyond Black Lives Matter, After Black Lives Matter, he talks a lot about kind of the failures of the Great Society liberals that are descendants of New Deal liberals. New Deal liberals and Great Society liberals are gone. We don't even have that. All we have now is third way Democrats.
And Reaganites.
That's it. So the way we're seeing the world hasn't changed much. And as much as we'd like to believe the needle moved very drastically in 2016, Ben and I were talking, and you know, Toussaint, you and I have had Pascal. We've had conversations privately about this, you know, to no end. The needle really hasn't moved as much as we would like to think it has. And there's just a lot of angry lib talk. And so what the Mad Max syndrome is for me is it's all about punishment. Who is going to get punished? Law enforcement's out of line. They must be punished. We really had no mechanisms to punish law enforcement the way we really wanted to, right? We wanted to show them. And so now we're dealing with the pushback. And we're also dealing with the fact that we never really had an infrastructure set into place, because since the conversation on a wider mainstream media scale, you know, here in this space, people did try to get more into the weeds about trying to have some sort of answers to poverty. But the solution was, and has been for a long time, especially in places like where I'm from in the Bay Area, well, you know, let's stop sentencing people these long ass fucking terms for quality of life crimes. But all you see constantly is quality of life crimes, sometimes escalating a little bigger. So the conversation in just a matter of a few years has shifted so drastically from one of, it is law enforcement, rogue law enforcement, that is the problem. And once we stop rogue law enforcement and funnel these funds into other programs, or once we rename this and call it that, once we get mental health professionals to step in and do the job that these armed people were doing at one point in time, everything will be fixed. We will have fixed all these problems. And we haven't. We haven't come close to it. Again, the answer in a place like San Francisco, one of the most expensive places to live in the country, is to bring in more law enforcement and now actually arrest people for crimes that we didn't arrest them for before. And that's a pretty, you know, short-sighted solution to a problem. Rent control is never the answer, right? That's never it. And when we say things like, well, just house them, just find a house for them. When you look at the Wood Street encampment, and we had people on from the Wood Street encampment, we've had them on multiple times. Not everybody wants to go into housing because you may not have it for a long period of time. You may only have it for a few months. You may lose it for a plethora of reasons. If you even, one of the reasons why it didn't even get swept as fast as it got swept was because the judge that, you know, put an injunction on Caltrans, who owned the land, was like, you have to find suitable housing for these people. At the time, the city of Oakland said, we only have 40 beds available. And the judge was like, well, you better figure something out. And they didn't even have the manpower to have resource people out there to try to help people get housing. And only a small amount of people actually wanted housing. Housing comes with rules. Not everybody wants rules. There's something to be said about paying rent and having, you know, just kind of the basic rules, right? You have a little rent. I don't know what you guys' rental agreement looks like. Again, I live next door to my landlord, and we don't even have, I don't even sign rental agreements anymore. She just walks over and says, are you staying? And I say, yeah. She goes, all right, we're good. But we did have a little one-page rental agreement. There's like these little rules on there, right? But when you have housing that's subsidized by municipality, there's all kinds of rules, and it's really easy to lose them. And also keep in mind, if you haven't had your own place for a while, you probably don't know how to just navigate paying a bill. Sometimes there's bills you have to pay. Sometimes, not all the time. Sometimes you have to live with people you may not have had to live with people in that kind of setting in some time. You may be handicapped. You may need certain services that just aren't provided. And I'm not saying that housing shouldn't be given because of these reasons. I'm saying that it's just more complicated. And sometimes people feel like, it's just easier to stay here. So not everybody even got a house. So you have a series of people just kind of moving around from street to street to street to street to street. The reason why people went to Wood Street in the first place was because it was quiet. And when I say quiet, I mean police weren't going to mess with you there. Did people get murdered down there? Oh, of course. Did cats find dead bodies down there? Of course. Did crazy criminal activity go on out there? Of course. I've seen some things. I was like, I can't believe I saw a human run over another human with a vehicle like that and not stop. Jesus Christ. But what is the solution to these problems? When you have Mad Max syndrome. I start the piece off literally describing what it looked like where I lived. And it sounds like I'm describing the beginning of one of these movies. No, this was really what people huddled over a garbage can on fire. There was 836 fires in 2022 in that area. 836 fires. I personally have seen 6 RVs explode. I don't even know how many cars I've seen explode. But the solution to all this stuff is like, okay, well, either you're just going to put them away, or we don't have to see them anymore. Move them out of the way, so we don't have to deal with them anymore. But that's kind of where it begins and ends. Or we're just going to arrest our way out of it. We've been trying to arrest our way out of this problem in just where I'm from for the last 50 years.
Do you think that the extreme nature of the social fracture is so beyond the normative contemplation of what we can expect in society that the normal inclination to technocratic responses is only going to give us vapid nonsense? In other words, the technocratic, let's do a policy study, let's do a think tank kind of, you know, give me a whatever, you know, Microsoft Office spreadsheet of 2,000 options of, you know, a Harvard Business School study of the whatever technocratic crap that comes out of these elite institutions that we've been using since the rise of, you know, institutional policy studies in the early 20th century. Is it possible that that way of thinking that you solve problems, right? Mm-hmm. That institutional elite way of believing you solve problems has come to its end in actually being able to be effective? Because the nature of the problems are so extreme that they can't fit into these normal kind of bubbles of elite solutions.
Do you want to say something, Toussaint, before I answer that?
I wanted to sort of pivot, so I don't know how you want to deal with that.
Sure. You want me to answer the question first?
Go ahead.
Okay. In San Francisco, for example, they just did a study to see where the majority of people are coming from. They're like, a lot of these people can't live here, right? These homeless people. And they found out that tons of people aren't from the city. Meaning from the city, they don't lay their head there at night. They come there to either sell dope, cop dope, whatever, and then they go back to wherever it is that they live. That is going to enable initiatives within police departments, initiatives with the mayor's office to say, okay, we want to arrest all these people because they don't need to be here in the first place. When that becomes front page news in a city like San Francisco, the citizens go, these people aren't from here, get rid of them. Because the Mad Maxness of it is actually really affecting citizens. There was a police chase recently where a guy had pulled a woman out of a car. I think it was an older woman out of a car and stole her car. He called the cops, of course. Cops chased the man. And in their chase, the man in the stolen car hit someone on the sidewalk and killed him because he was trying to evade police. The technocratic solution says, well, that guy's not from here. Ergo, we need tougher sentences to put these people away because that becomes the response of the voting public, which means a lot, right? We're talking about people that do donate to parties, to candidates. And that matters, listening to these people. Tucson, did you want to pivot?
Sure. I just wanted to address the idea that you chose to call it a syndrome, mm-hmm. which I'm not entirely sure why you did that, mm-hmm. but it's apt. Syndrome is a constellation of symptoms. Mm-hmm. So it's not a disease on its own. Mm-mm. It's a bunch of symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to Pascal's point, the technocratic solutions are not working on the individual symptoms. We need something more systemic.
We can't think that way because part of the syndrome is, first and foremost, people believe we just arrived here quickly. Hmm. Right? and it didn't. It took years to get here. And there were failures along the way. And we never acknowledge those failures. And sometimes maybe the way we look back is flawed at what caused what. And you brought this up a few weeks ago on a show that you felt that there's people, especially in places like New York, and you and Pascal grew up in a very different New York than the one that exists right now, pre-Giuliani New York, mm-hmm. where people are afraid of that time. You know, rewatching some of these silly movies like Death Wish 3, every movie goes from New York, LA, New York, LA, New York, LA, if you want to know. Death Wish 3 goes back to this New York that is just cartoonish. Mm. But New York was still violent at this time. This is pre-Giuliani New York. This is Bernard Goetz New York, mm-hmm. right? And this is a time where people are literally frightened of beautiful places like Central Park. You have back-to-back high-profile murders in Central Park, or you have assaults. You have a murder with the preppy murderer that was a huge high-profile case, and then you have the Central Park Five and an extremely brutal rape that, of course, those kids didn't do. And shout out to one of them is up for winning a city council seat.
Oh, wow.
So shout out. This is a frightening time for New York. You have a lot of ethnic violence going on at the same time. Pre-Giuliani New York is a different place. I mean, Pascal, do you want to get into pre-Giuliani New York?
It's a rough town, man. Ed Koch, New York City, racially balkanized, a lot of ethnic tension, a very divided town. The city is still actually recalibrating from the economic losses of the 70s.
Now, that didn't happen overnight, correct?
No.
4 to New York City, drop dead.
Drop right. Dead.
You know, so, but we like to think that these things happen overnight. So the solutions have to be overnight. And this is, and then we're talking like in the mid 80s. And we did a show called Is Hip Hop Revolutionary? Boy, oh boy, did we get some great comments on that one. But to the idea that some of these things are revolutionary, the people that I know in that genre loved Giuliani. Pascal, I'm sure you know people, probably in your family, that loved Giuliani because he did what? He cleaned up the city.
Yeah.
He cleaned up Times Square.
He gave Times Square to Disney. Now it is a place for children, mm-hmm. not just
prostitutes.
Prostitutes, serial killers, and ne'er-do-wells, right?
That's right. That's right.
So people that I love wax very poetic about the Giuliani change of New York City. That came at a price. Stop and frisk.
Right.
Stop and frisk is back. And no one's really complaining that much. If all the images that are getting people to watch the news are of bands of kids running into a department store to steal sneakers, clothes, or a Walgreens for deodorant and razors, then you're going to really think that this is a problem. Since I've been able to drive, San Francisco had car theft. Now it's the biggest issue on the news. It sucks to get your car broken into. I fucking hate it. Ugh. You ever got your car broken into, Pascal Toussaint?
One time.
Sucks. Toussaint, I forgot Toussaint is a New Yorker. She can't drive.
That's right. We have an excellent transit system.
But these things kind of create this moment where people believe that you are living in this kind of Charles Bronson, Australian outback place where, you know, police have to go the extra mile to protect the citizens. And as a citizen that grew up in an environment like that, it's scary. I have friends that were killed for saying words. Words. They weren't in gangs. Just said the wrong word to the wrong cat. Caught the wrong bullet. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it was kind of scary. And what is the solution that you give to people that may have children that have to go to school with some kids that have guns?
Keep your mouth shut. There was a time when they were slashing people on the subway.
My mother
was always like, hey, man, you got a mouth on you. You might want to keep it shut. Somebody says something to you. Yeah. We do have a super chat.
Let's get it.
Strom McCallum says, we can both despise NIMBYism, capitalism, and recognize that lumpenism is nothing to celebrate. We can look up Tent City in Charleston. It was a nightmare for its inhabitants and its proletarian neighbors.
Strom, you are saying some scary stuff. Because you can't talk about encampments as anything other than some sort of, you know, wonderful anarchistic playground of creativity and joy. And they're not. They're not fun to be around. They're not fun to live in. Like, have you ever lived on the street? It's not a pleasant feeling to not have a place to go use the bathroom. Or to feel guilty to try to use the bathroom. Everything's private. Again, the big reason why you see the blow up of encampments is because people can't be in public parks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you have so many street encampments. The park is off limits. And when you do have people in public parks, you have to start asking yourself a question. What do we want out of our public spaces? And what is humane? And these are uncomfortable questions to ask because they may not fall in line with liberal orthodoxy. I'm not going to say left. It's not a left position. It's a very liberal position. So how do you try to address people that have lost everything, but yet and still say, maybe I don't want you shooting up where my kid plays on the slide or wants to roll around on the grass and you just throw needles around?
To which I say, too late. It is there.
I mean, Pascal, what do you want?
I mean, this is the conundrum for me is that I don't see any quick solutions for these problems. I don't see any simple answers. And I see the worst inclinations coming from the way we frame policy today, which is just lock them up, put them away, you know, or sometimes throw money at it or even not throw money at it or act like you're throwing money at it when you're really not. So, again, I wish we had more humane policy creators who are more creative as well that can come up with solutions to these problems. Because I don't see the normal status quo institutions that have been charged to address our ills being capable of doing so, because I believe that our institutions are in a state of decline.
Here's my response to that. These problems didn't happen overnight, and the solution doesn't happen overnight, and the solution may not happen within an election cycle. So the solutions, beyond just being technocratic, have to give a veneer of sensitivity and also tough on crime. Because that's what the citizens want. Your voting base wants you to be tough on the people that did the bad thing. This is all moralizing bullshit, right? Be tough on that. I didn't rob anybody. I didn't steal shoes. I didn't do these things. I don't do drugs. Be tough on those people. But still be somewhat humane, right? We want it all. But the reality is, let's just use a hotel, for example. Let's say you have a bunch of homeless people living in a park, and nearby said park, you have a motel that may be on hard times. And you say, we have the budget. Let's buy this motel and we'll turn it into housing. People can have individual rooms. You're going to get them out of the park, but whatever was in the park is now in the motel, right? So the motel, if the park was a little hellscape, the motel is going to be a little hellscape. And you're going to have different kinds of people. You're going to have people that, you know, maybe just have families. You're going to have people that actually go to work. You're going to have people that just do drugs. You're going to have all the things. It's going to suck for a while. It's probably going to take you quite a few years to figure out what works exactly. It's probably going to be a hard thing to keep funded. But everybody has to be on board. The citizens have to understand that this park didn't happen this way overnight. These people didn't come here overnight. This is years of policies that have, you know, punished people maybe unjustly for crimes, especially drug crimes. Now we're starting to punish. We want to punish people again for like petty theft where we stopped doing that. It is very, very hard to go from being incarcerated back into the world without support. Do you know how many people don't have families looking for them when they get out? Mm-hmm. It is very, very hard to go back into the world. We have to be prepared to try to start building a world that's more accepting of these people that are, you know, that are probably filling the park. We have to figure out how we're going to fund services for people in this hotel or motel. And we have to let people know this isn't going to be beautiful in 4 years. It may take 8 years just to have this place running the way we want it to run, because some things may not work. No politician is having that conversation. Not near one.
That's, I don't even, we have a body politic who's willing to accept that.
No. No. But that's really how the conversation has to start. It's going to take some time. It is going to get ugly. Because what happens, right? You move the people into the hotel, and again, whatever was going on in the park goes on in the hotel. In San Francisco, and I speak about this so much because I'm from the Bay Area, so for people that are watching the show that don't know, there was a woman that infested a building with rats. She definitely was not all there and infested a building with rats. And she got moved to another building, did the same thing again. Just a problem. How do you want to deal with this woman? She cannot live totally alone. But this is a throwaway population for lawmakers. And that's a really hard thing to swallow. Because everything I'm talking about right now is kind of what Bertram talks about. This is the poor. These are the people that are below the poverty line. These are the people that don't vote. A lot of them can't vote. This is the real surplus population. No one really gives that much of a damn about this population. When Bert writes that piece, it goes, for a lot of black poor, affirmative action, just ending, it's just Tuesday. And this is the population that we're talking about here. And there are people that live within this population that aren't part of a criminal underworld, haven't been incarcerated. But this is also the population that will have negative interactions with law enforcement, oftentimes when calling law enforcement for assistance. Another thing that's kind of going to sound effed up is that there was a lot of virtue hoarding in 2020 from a lot of middle-class people of color that acted as if the realities of the poor were theirs and every person of color. And that's just not true. Negative interactions with police are so different when you're on different class scales and financial structure scales, right? Pascal, I'm sure you've had an interaction with law enforcement in your
Years of life.
Toussaint, I know you've had an interaction with law enforcement in your...
Unfortunately.
We'll just say 20 plus years of life for you.
20 plus. Unfortunately, yes, I have.
Right? These interactions, depending on where you fit,
yeah,
can be frightening.
They're always frightening to me. Things can go anyway. Anyway.
They can. But the amount of just virtue hoarding that happened in 2020. it really made me angry. Because I was like, none of you are driving around like me with no insurance and no license and bad tax, which I just got not too long ago. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, thank you to all the super chatters and thank you to my TIR family. You guys were really worried about, as I was worried. You know, I don't drive a nice car. My car is very obviously from far away a bucket. And when you drive one of those cars in the right area, oof, on the right day. So I think simple solutions, right? We're always looking at the problem wrong. Law enforcement definitely is a problem.
Can I read this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Finland solved their homeless problem. It can be done if the will is there, but the problem is that somebody has to be made a billionaire solving the problem in the U.S. Mm.
Finland and the United States are drastically different from a population standpoint. And they're drastically different from a social safety net standpoint and a belief in how the government is going to handle the people. The relationship is different.
Just a little bit of that would make such a difference here.
Oh, we talk about this all the time. All the time, right? Smallest reform would go the longest way. Medicare for All is a reform. It's a capitalist liberal reform. If we had that, woo, I could finally get that camera in my behind.
Okay, you should elaborate on that and then never talk about it again.
I'm not. Okay. But, you know,
I'll leave it there.
Yeah, where the camera should be. But seriously, you know, the way many other countries approach the welfare state is not what we have in the United States. And a billionaire would really only do so much. Again, $17 billion was thrown at housing in just California alone. And you have the largest amount of homeless people in the country in California. They're not coming here for the weed. So I'm not trying to poo-poo. So I apologize if it sounds like I'm trying to poo-poo that idea. It's just realistically, you can't look at the Scandinavian countries and say, well, if we just acted more like that, everything would be fine. If there was just the political will. That goes back into the syndrome.
Right.
If someone just had the will to save us. It's not about individual will. It's about group understanding of societal failures. Individual will not fix this. There's never going to be a politician that's going to wake up one morning and say, I have to do this for the people. Politicians, even at the state level, even at the city council level. I'll tell you a true story. Excuse me. Bill Cody, I think I can say this, worked for a city council member who used to be an activist who, for all intents and purposes, was a longtime Marxist. Was very instrumental in getting the driver's license bill done in California that allowed undocumented people to get a driver's license so they get a job. Was instrumental in the first DREAM Act that happened on the state level. His constituents lived in a building that the tenant to the little contract to build the building when they built it 30 years ago was like, you can build this building and we'll give you some state subsidies, but it has to be, you have to have so many affordable units in it. It has to be affordable housing. For 30 years, you don't have to disclose that to a renter. I don't know too many people that want to see, well, how'd you build this place 30 years ago on the rental agreement, especially in an environment where it's just so hard to find housing, period. And we're talking about affordable housing. So you're talking about people that probably have vouchers and they're just happy that anyone's accepting a voucher, right? So one day, landlord goes, or owner of the building goes, all right, our 30 years are up. Let's raise the rents to market. Little old ladies living on Social Security get their rent bill. It's now $1,000 higher. They get upset. They actually formed a tenants union. Brought it to the city council member who was Gil, longtime activist. He knows he's on his way out. And it suggested to him, just ignore it, it'll go away. Because, you know, you can't win here. There's nothing we can do. Just ignore it, it'll go away. He goes, we're going to take this on. We're going to fix this. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to get this property with eminent domain. We're going to buy it from the owner. These people can stay here in perpetuity with this rent and blah, 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 blah. The whole time, the city's saying, bitch, we don't have the money. And think about the precedent you were trying to set. There's tens of thousands of these things about to come due in the next 5 years. We can't do this every 5 minutes. We just don't have the money. Does it anyway. Now there's still, the last I checked, nothing had really happened in the place. I think people kind of got to keep their rents at a certain level, but the city still hasn't purchased the building. That's a man, sheer force of will, trying to stay true to his, to who he feels he is. As someone that listens to and fights for the people, literally just couldn't do it. He couldn't do anything. In that situation, I ask, because I don't know the answer, and I'm just asking the question. You guys tell me. Would you rather him go, sorry, nothing I can do here? Or say, I'm going to fight for you, and then there's really nothing that's going to happen?
Well, I'd rather him fight sincerely and try his best, not just capitulate.
Well, either way, you're going to get the same nothing burger. Okay. So,
well, you're not always going to win. That doesn't mean you shouldn't fight.
Okay. I'm asking the question. I don't have the answer. But, you know, that is the sad reality of the world that we live in. Kush looks at, this is why I'm a bit of a Maoist. I feel you on that. I think some of the guys on this show have a little bit of Maoist in them.
Maoist in the room. Maoist in the room. Maoist in the room. Maoist in the room. I haven't heard that one in a while.
That's right.
So, do you guys have anything to say since you wouldn't ask me all these long ass questions?
Nah, man.
So we know where this black pilling is coming from now.
Yeah, it's called I Live in California. I'm from California. That's what it is.
It's called I'm from California and I moved out of the States. And when I watch the news, it's like, how do you people live there?
I lived in it, man. I lived in the bottom of that trash bin for a long time and saw how people treat people that live in the bottom of that trash bin. And it is, I don't even have the word. I don't have the vocabulary to say how it feels to have people feel very comfortable dumping trash on your street daily. So Dr. Claw says, jabronis say California is communist. Like, I don't know where that's coming from. Take them to Orange County. Take them there for 5 minutes.
Tell them jabronis be off for gazies.
Tell them that California gave you Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon.
Word.
Tell them California gave you the welfare queen and welfare reform. So that's the California that I know.
Steve, just so you know, Jason said that you're probably light-skinned with freckles. I don't know why he said that or how he would know, but that's what he said, Steve.
Dr. Claw says California gave us Prop 22. Exactly.
It did.
You know, we didn't even get into that whole aspect of my diatribe about Mad Max syndrome, which is, you know, the war on the gig economy. I feel like post Prop 22, so I'll try to be brief. I know I'm rambled for an hour. People just don't give a damn about one of the largest sectors of the working class. Like, what do you have to say about that, Pascal?
They really don't, man. This is some real black pill stuff we're going into here, man. This the overall lack of regard for the working class, the institutional inability to deal with many of these crisis problems, the way in which our infrastructure is crumbling. Mm-hmm. Way to go, Jason.
Good job.
I appreciate what Gil tried to do in helping those people. As someone says, it is the right thing to do. That's why he got into politics. There's an old guard, most of them are gone now, that felt like if they were going to change the world, they do it through the political realm. Now, young people that want to change the world are going to do it through philanthropy. That sucks. How are we going to make the world a better place? I think we all try in some capacity. I feel very confident that everyone watching this show does something in their area to try to build community, to try to build true social bonds, because that's really where it starts. Communities have to be strong if we want to try to tackle these problems seriously. We cannot be afraid of our neighbors. We have to be able to form these bonds, build this cadre, so we can say, no, we don't want to just have a titular role on some sort of city council where we really have no say in controlling law enforcement. We want to really have a say in controlling law enforcement. We want to have a say in the training. We don't want cops living an hour outside of the city. We want to know our firemen. We don't want to give subsidies to Walmart and Target. So the moment that they've soaked up all the money they can leave and leave a ghost town. Has anybody watching this show ever seen a place where a Walmart's left in Oakland where Walmart left? That's where it's a hell zone over there. I feel comfortable and confident the people that are watching this show are trying to build that wherever they're watching. So, on that note, we're going to go into the champagne room and definitely fuck with Pascal about pop locking and his step show days when he was Dean, Big Brother Almighty.
All
right. Wait, is this you, Pascal? Is this you? Is you this one?
Oh, no, that's a different fraternity.
That's a different.
Anyway, moving
not
on.
Not a Q. He's not a Q.
What is that's not Sadate. That's not what that means.
Moving on.
So, if you guys are ready for Pascal pop locking, Jason and Tucson shit talking, a lot of fun house music. Join us in the champagne room Saturday. We're going to have Jay Arena on for a conversation about
privatization of charter schools.
More cheery fun from the folks over here at TIR. All right, are you ready?
Ready to roll?
Yeah.
All right, we are
out.
Black-pilled. Thank you.